Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Adventures in DevOps. We are doing an international episode today. I guess we usually do, but today it's more international, I think, than usual, because we have three countries represented. I'm in Guatemala visiting my in-laws this week. I'm joined today by Jillian.
Hello.
Where are you joining us from?
Doha, Qatar.
You're back home.
This week.
Back home in Doha. Yep. Will Button. Relative.
What's going on, everybody?
And our guest this week, Alan Helton. Alan, welcome. You're joining us from the great country of Texas, you said.
That's right. The one and only. Happy to be here.
Awesome. We're great to have you here. We're glad to have you here. It's great to have you here. Whatever.
I'm delighted to have you here.
Hey, folks, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately, I've been working on actually building out Top End Devs. If you're interested, you can go to topenddevs.com/podcast, and you can actually hear a little bit more about my story, about why I'm doing what I'm doing with Top End Devs, why I changed it from devchat.tv to Top End Devs. But what I really want to get into is that I have decided that I'm going to build the platform that I always wished I had with devchat.tv, and I renamed it to Top End Devs because I want to give you the resources that are going to help you to build the career that you want, right? So whether you want to be an influencer in tech, whether you want to go and just max out your salary and then go live a lifestyle with your family, your friends, or just traveling the world or whatever, I want to give you the resources that are going to help you do that. We're going to have career and leadership resources in there, and we're going to be giving you content on a regular basis to help you level up and max out your career. So go check it out at topenddevs.com. If you sign up before my birthday, that's December 14th. If you sign up before my birthday, you can get 50% off the lifetime of your subscription. Once again, that's topenddevs.com.
We're talking today about serverless and how that relates to DevOps. But before we jump into that, Alan, do you want to give us a brief introduction? Tell us who you are and maybe what you know about serverless and DevOps, and then we'll jump in.
Sure. My name's Alan Helton. I work for a company called Tyler Technologies. Been there for 10 years. I like to say, poached right out of college. I was given a full-time position at Tyler about 2 months before I graduated college. And I'll let you know, those were the hardest 2 months of my college career, knowing I already had a job locked down, just trying to see it through. Yeah, that was fun and rough all at the same time. I've been a developer for the majority of that 10-year time. I started off as a .NET engineer working on thick client apps, and kind of progressed from an entry level, working my way up to senior engineer, lead engineer. I was a manager for a couple of years, sitting at a cloud architect title for Tyler Technologies. So it's actually a relatively new role for me. I'm excited to kind of get in there and pave the way and set the standards for that. But as far as serverless goes, I was a manager for the past 3 years of two cloud native teams, and we go 100% serverless. So it was dive headfirst into the deep end of cloud tech, just discovering and trying to figure out everything from DevOps to honestly JavaScript. That was a new one for me. To serverless architecture in the cloud. So I've been working at kind of as a hybrid role, a cloud architect and development manager over the past couple of years while we learn about everything we can serverless.
So the thing that surprised me about that is not probably what you might expect, but the thing that surprised me is you said JavaScript is new to you. How did you get that far down in your career without JavaScript?
Honestly, it was just working in .NET thick client apps. There's not a lot of space for JavaScript there. You know, the front end is all WPF kind of thing. It wasn't writing in scripting languages. One of the biggest things that we did when we started serverless was, well, let's use .NET because that's what we know.
Of course, yeah.
And at the time, it wasn't very good. The AWS support for .NET, you would have like 30-second cold starts on Lambda functions. We quickly abandoned that. So we thought, oh, Python's cool. Let's try Python. So we tried that. Didn't like it a whole lot. And then we're like, let's try JavaScript. And we went over there and we're like, well, I mean, the front end's kind of already written in that anyway. So let's do it for the back end too. and that's how we landed there. So
I guess I should have taken a different career path because I really don't like JavaScript. Maybe I should have been a .NET guy so I could avoid that.
You should have been a Perl CGI guy is what you should have done.
I was for 12 years.
Yeah, I was too. I know. We all were at some point. So, Alan,
why didn't you do Perl for serverless?
I can still range the
period. Yeah, everything's not the time.
Perl. Anyway.
Everything is at some point. You know, so Alan, I think I'm going to play the role of the skeptic on this show in that I don't get serverless. Like, I haven't even looked at it much because I'm like, I know there's a server there. I think you're trying to keep me away from it, and I don't know how I feel about that. So, like, I need this explained to me in kind of, I don't know, you know, anxiety-reducing terms. What is the serverless? What is it doing? What is it keeping away from me? What if I need access? Because I know that there's a server in there somewhere, right? I don't believe this, but I'll let you take it.
Sure. No, you're right. There are servers in serverless, but the whole gist of it is as a developer, as someone that's writing in serverless and using serverless tech, you don't care. It's abstracted away from you by the cloud vendor. I don't have to go in and worry about maintaining operating systems, installing packages, going and configuring load balancers or anything like that. I just don't care. That's what we're paying AWS to do, manage that for me. So me and my team of developers can focus 100% of our time on business problems. You know, when we're triaging an issue, we're triaging business problems in the code, not environment issues.
So y'all are trying to code me out of a job again? This is like the third career path that I've been coded out of. I had a really big one for the whole thing. Was just installing bioinformatics software. That was it. That was my whole job. And then Conda coded me out of that job. And now I guess serverless is it going to code me out of the DevOps job? What do we think, guys?
Well, I mean, that's it's still a thing. Somebody works for the cloud vendors doing this. You can still go there.
You like AWS, Billy? Why don't you just go work for them?
No, I want for them to funnel money to me. Is the way that I want for that relationship to work.
See what happened there? You said the word work, Jonathan, and she turned it into the word funnel. I think there's a lesson to be learned there.
Probably so.
So the way the money should be flowing.
So what does your DevOps workflow look like in a serverless? And you said you guys are 100% serverless, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What's your DevOps workflow or DevOps environment look like in that type of situation?
So we run a CI/CD pipeline where everything that we're deploying into the cloud is written in infrastructure as code, which is really where that DevOps kind of piece comes in. A serverless engineer is just as much a DevOps engineer as dedicated DevOps engineers are, because they're the ones that are actually controlling the infrastructure that's getting pushed out to the cloud. And I see Jillian smiling, trying to hold back. Maybe I'm a little overstepping my bound on that one a little bit, but let me actually pull that back. There's a lot of DevOps crossover with serverless engineers. You know, you're not going in and maintaining the servers, like we said, and installing updates, configuring load balancers, but you are saying, this is what I want as my infrastructure up in the cloud. So that's kind of how that's the gist of what we're running. We are, as part of the development process, we're defining the infrastructure and saying, this part of the infrastructure runs this code. This is how you target it. This is how it links to this other piece. Go. And it goes out to the cloud. And you know, with the CI/CD mentality, we're pushing lots of tiny changes every day going up there, you know, running automated tests, get proactive monitoring in there.
Yeah, I think I see where you're going there. And that's kind of it's been one of my goals with every team I've worked with is to push as much of the environment back onto the development team as possible, or not really push it onto them, but give them the control of what it looks like, because they know better than I do, you know, how much memory does it need? What's your auto scaling threshold? All of that kind of stuff. They have that knowledge. And so I try to build tools that allow them to just maintain that themselves, which ultimately turns into infrastructure as code.
Yeah, so this is interesting. What happens? So you're saying most of your kind of job is triaging business problems. So can you kind of take us through the pipeline from problem comes in to kind of what that pipeline looks like until the code is actually developed that fixes that problem or mitigates it in some way?
Definitely. So let's say a client reports an issue. We have, you know, something that's not doing what it's supposed to do. Typically how we do it is try to reproduce first. You know, that's generally triage step number one. Can I reproduce it? And by doing that, what we do is we get access to what API is causing a problem. The development that we do with the products that we work on is API first. So everything starts with the API. It's not necessarily driven by the user interface, but you know, we have dedicated focus on what that API looks like. So we have really strongly defined ins and outs around our APIs and our endpoints. So we identify which one is it. And the beautiful thing about serverless is that once you know what API or what endpoint is causing problems, you have one spot to look. The beauty of it is that one endpoint equals one, in AWS's case, Lambda function. And a Lambda function is, at least it should, be single responsibility. It does one thing and one thing only. And that provides a super easy way to go in and triage. If I know what endpoint, I can go to the Lambda function immediately and troubleshoot a business logic problem in, let's say, 50 lines of code, because that's all that's confined in that area. I'm not sharing a bunch of code in a controller or anything. It's really one tiny silo that I'm looking at. Obviously, it gets a little bit more difficult once you start throwing in things like choreography and async development processes. But they're all, you know, AWS and all the cloud vendors are super aware of how difficult that is. And they make it pretty easy by tossing trace IDs in your choreography. So if it goes from a Lambda function and gets broadcasted out with like an SNS topic, you can put in a trace to say, well, where's it going? Who's picking it up?
What's choreography? And
just kind of, what's choreography? Great question. So choreography is, well, you know, if you think about it from the dance meaning of the word, it's I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to do this move over here with programming choreography. There's two main types of workflows, I guess. There's choreography and there's orchestration. Let me start with the easier one. Orchestration is very procedural. It's I know when I'm looking at it, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this. But with choreography in event-driven architectures, it's I'm going to do this, then I'm going to tell people that I'm done. And the people that care that I'm done are going to pick it up and do something else with it. And then when that's done, I'm going to say that I'm done. And whoever cares picks that up. So you don't really get a kind of one shot, what's the flow? It's all with publishers and subscribers who care about one thing, and it's when is this event being fired?
Cool. Yeah, that kind of leads into sort of the next thing that I was thinking about, which is, I mean, either you have a big kind of monolithic framework that has a bunch of modules and a bunch of functions, or you have a bunch of these individual functions, but sort of naively not really knowing a whole lot about serverless, it kind of seems like it would be more difficult to keep track of a bunch of little things than one big thing. So how do you keep, is that how you keep track of things, is through this orchestration and through the trace IDs and that's how you do it? Are there specific frameworks out there to help you deal with serverless? Like what does that look like from kind of a top level view?
Well, would you mind explaining your question a little bit more? Because I could answer that a couple different ways, but I want to make sure I'm answering it the right way.
Really just being it. So let's say I have an application and that application is calling many, many functions. So today I was working on an application, right, that has like a front end, and then the front end calls a bunch of different little APIs, right? And there, I suppose they could all be traced back to the front end that is a particular data set. And if I had presumably thousands of those, how do I keep track of like, okay, I have a problem somewhere. Where is the problem? Which serverless function does it point to? Do you group things by application type? Do you group them by business type? Do they have tags? Like, I really have no idea here. So I'm going into this very blind and maybe asking some stupid questions.
No, that's not a dumb question at all. Because when I first started down this boat, people asked me the same question. They thought, well, that's not a smart way to build big enterprise applications, because what happens when you get hundreds or thousands of Lambda functions? How do you manage that? Really, my immediate response is, how would you do it with the standard monolithic app? It's still the same amount of code, but it's really not that bad. it goes to planning and microservices in bounded contexts. So the way that we tend to run things is you have domain microservices. where you have a set of related functions that do things with a specific entity or type of entity. So everything that has to do with this, I'll use an industry example. So one of the applications that I work on is with warrants, like arrest warrants and search warrants. So everything that has to do with a warrant is put in a warrant microservice where we have all of our, let's say 40 or 50 different functions that do CRUD operations or procedural things live there in that microservice. And a microservice for us, really, you could just say is a repository, a repo in GitHub, where it's separated out and everything that has to do with this lives here. If I want to look at something else, I will go and switch repositories to a different one. Really, it's a governance thing, you know, because you could easily slip, you know, that's a slippery slope if you start crossing bounded contexts or just want to put everything in one. Does that answer your question, Jillian? Maybe some?
I think so. It's becoming clearer. No,
but one of the misconceptions that I think a lot of people have with serverless development is I'm not in the AWS console all day, every day. That's not my job. My job is to write code, and I use an IDE on my machine to write that code just like any other application. As far as like building apps serverless versus building the thick client applications that I used to work on, it's essentially the same developer experience. I just have a little bit different responsibilities. I'm pulling code down from a repository, making changes, and checking that code in. And part of the build pipeline goes and puts it into the cloud. So I'm not ever really looking at lists in the AWS console of 1,000 different Lambda functions, trying to figure out, okay, what am I trying to change? What am I trying to find? I'm just digging through code like any other app.
That segues into some of my questions, which is about the developer experience. When you're working with serverless code, are you able to do local unit testing, for example? Do you set up a local environment to do testing? Just maybe walk me through a typical feature or bug fix that you would do on a serverless function, and how does that compare to a monolithic application, as you were talking about earlier?
Yeah. So another thing, if you're looking to get started with serverless, don't fall into this pitfall I'm about to talk about. Don't try to bring the cloud to your workstation. Bring your workstation to the cloud. You know, traditionally, you know, we're very used to walking through debugging sessions, right? We're executing the code locally. We put a breakpoint in the code and we hit F10 or F11, boom, 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 walk line by line. With the cloud stuff and specifically with serverless, it's not really like that. AWS has made some significant efforts to make it as easy as possible to take your local development environment and push it into the cloud. We use what's called the SAM CLI, which is an acronym for Serverless Application Manager, I believe. Don't work for AWS, so I'm allowed to not know what that stands for. And what it does is it has this new feature that was released, I think, at the end of last year called SAM Sync. And what it does is it syncs up with your AWS account. So every time you hit save, it deploys your changes into the cloud. And you can run your local unit tests against your AWS environment that you're using for dev. And it will tail logs and bring them back down to your console. So it's not really running local at all. It's running in the cloud, but you can see what it's doing local.
So you're not going to be able to do that sitting on an airplane with no Wi-Fi access. But for almost any other scenario, you're going to be built. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are... You can develop local if you want. It involves, you know, setting up some Docker configuration, and it does actually support that, but that's not the recommended one.
Fair enough. Good.
So if you are on a plane for however many hours, I don't know how long your flight was to Guatemala, but you can do it. It's not like you don't have that choice.
Yeah, good.
So correct me if I'm wrong here, but isn't one of the key ways to be successful with serverless is to make, you know, you mentioned making sure that your Lambda functions are really small and really tight. And then the output of those functions, like it receives some data input and then it either does something and returns that or does something and puts it out on a queue for something else to pick up, right? So it's very limited in scope.
Yep. Yep. You're just building a bunch of little blocks and trying to chain them together. You know, AWS has well over 200 different services that you can use. Not all of them are serverless, but they all communicate really well with each other, and they all have very specific use cases and purposes. You know, a lot of times you have to take into consideration what's the scale at which one of my API endpoints is going to run. Like, for example, not me, but I have spoken with some companies that have just otherworldly amount of scale called hyperscale, where it's 10,000 to 100,000 requests a second, you know, millions of requests a second. It's just unbelievable. What they do is they don't run synchronous responses there. Basically, if you have your API endpoint, and what it does is it just pushes that into a queue and works off of that queue in AWS. That's the SQS service, simple queue service. And it has a Lambda function that just picks off that queue whenever something's available. And it just processes that. And, you know, based on what you've designed in your infrastructure, it will notify the caller in whatever way, be it a WebSocket or an email or a text message when that operation is done. It's really cool. There's a whole lot of stuff that you can do with to solve a variety of different problems. That's one of the things that I really like about serverless when it comes to DevOps specifically. So I don't really have to worry about scaling. It does it for you. That's one of the benefits of using a cloud vendor, is that Lambda functions scale automatically based on the load. You can have up to 1,000 Lambda functions running concurrently in there, and it could be the same Lambda function. You could have 1,000 of these things processing the same type of request going at all times. And that's even a soft limit. Like, you can up the scale and the throughput very easily to do stuff like that. And it's what's nice about that, again, to kind of track back to what I was saying earlier, is the developers don't have to care about things that we've traditionally cared about before. It's really, let's focus on the business problem.
Certain things are more complicated or at least different when you're doing serverless, though, right? I mean, if you need to talk to a database, you have to integrate with the database service, or RDS or something like that. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean,
if you need to do caching or anything with state, I guess, really, is kind of what I'm getting at. Anything with state, you can't rely on a global variable in your function maintaining that state for you.
That's true. That is totally true. Serverless is stateless. And you have to, you take that into consideration when you're designing your application. You know, so if I'm trying to maintain a state, like your example, Jonathan, if I was designing some random thing to do what you just said, first thing I would do in some of these functions is read and write from the database. Let's get the state. We're not persisting it in the server, but we're persisting it in the database instead, and we're fetching it. And it's really not hard to go and do stuff like that. There's SDKs, so it ends up being like two lines code. Say, all right, hit this table, give me this object, and you know, carry on.
How does that affect a typical pattern for a microservice, for example? If you connect to the database, you open a database connection pool, and it sits there for the entire lifetime of your application, and you just reuse your connections as you need to. With serverless, do we have something similar, or are you reconnecting the database on every function call? Because that sounds inefficient, but I'm sure that they thought of this. What's the solution?
I don't have a great answer for you, but I have a great reason why. I don't have to know about that. That's AWS's problem. we use DynamoDB. We use a NoSQL database for everything that we write, and it scales up to hundreds of thousands of connections a second. It might even be more than that, where I don't have to care about connection pools and persisting connections or anything like that, because that's what the cloud provider is offering to me.
Right.
I can provide a little bit of insight there, because what will happen is a Lambda function, once it's invoked, it'll stay up and running. So when it's invoked, if it opens up a DB connection and then does its thing, it'll sit there idle for a certain amount of time. And if another request comes in, then it'll process that request too. And so a Lambda function may have an extended life as long as you keep asking it to do things. But then once it goes idle for a certain amount of time, that's whenever it would close down, shut down the database connection, and then the next request would launch a new Lambda function with a new DB connection.
You sound like an expert.
And there's actually a lot of tricks. There's a lot of tricks that you can use kind of along those lines to increase performance Like JavaScript offers a unique environment variable that you can provide to Lambda functions that say persist connections to do exactly what you just said, Will. Oh. And you can there are things that you can do to also take advantage of these Lambda functions potentially living for n number of executions where n is greater than one. Example, if I'm loading secrets, same secret, right? But it's stored securely. I'm loading a secret to go use on some API I'm integrating with. What you can do is you can store those secrets after you load them for the first time in a global variable that's scoped to that Lambda function that will store those for the life of the Lambda function's uptime, which, you know, could be 10 minutes, could be an hour based on the load, could be whatever. But little nice tricks and nuances that you learn when you're in there, you know, all the time trying to figure out how do we make this faster? Because one of the things that we haven't talked about with serverless is that it's pay for uptime.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, right. Which means that if you're writing code that's not performant, you're just throwing dollars away. You pay, you know, fractions and fractions and fractions of a penny for an invocation of a Lambda function. You also pay for how much memory that Lambda function has used and what its uptime was when it's actually running your code. You're not going to pay for it sitting idle while it's waiting for another connection, but while it's running your code, you pay for that. And you get billed down to the millisecond. So if I have a really slow function that takes, say, 5 seconds, that's a pretty slow function. But it doesn't need to, right? Because I maybe could have broken out of a loop or called something a little bit easier, kicked an async process off instead of waiting for it. You know, if I get that down to 200 milliseconds, that ends up saving you a lot of money. You know, it's a different mindset trying to optimize for performance, not just because of the user experience, but because of cost. And that ends up driving a lot of architectural decisions and whatnot, because you have to figure out what gets the job done and what gets the job efficiently as far as cost goes.
So folks, I'm here with JD from Raygun. JD, you guys get like a billion errors a month. What are some of the more interesting errors that you've seen over the years?
Oh, that's a good question. We certainly deal with a lot of errors. A couple of things come to mind. When we very first launched, and we kind of expected, you know, we'd see some people sign up and try it, we actually got one of the top 10 Facebook games. Remember when they were huge? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so they one of the top 10 Facebook games, and it was, between us, one of the most buggy bits of software I've ever seen. And so it managed to completely blow us off the internet in like our first week of launching. So we solved
that. That's why I couldn't win at poker.
Those Farmville animals. No.
Yeah.
And there was another one always sticks in my mind, because obviously we track JavaScript, and just like with mobile error crash reporting, you know, you can't access the end user's browser console to see errors. So you really want to track that and report it.
Right.
And I remember this one customer, and they had this really fancy animation on the cursor on their website. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, their JavaScript to do that, they deployed a bug with it, which meant that on every single mouse move event of every single customer they had would send an error report to Raygun. So working at Raygun is like dealing with a constant distributed denial of service attack and doing it with style.
So if you want to know what kinds of interesting things are going on that you're not seeing in your app, you ought to check out Raygun. They're doing a free trial right now. You can get it at raygun.com.
So that's one of my favorite topics. What kind of analysis or metrics do you share across your team related to the cost of the Lambda functions that they're responsible for?
That's an area that I could probably do better on. I haven't spent as much time probing and figuring that out. But what we do is we have dashboards that show our expensive Lambda functions, which ones are on average running over a second. And there's some that are allowed to, right? The things that we're integrating with for, you know, external APIs. But there's also many that aren't allowed to. And by allowed, you know, that's a governance thing that our team is putting in place, where we say everything should respond in, you know, less than 500 milliseconds. So that's right now, that's kind of what we do. You know, CloudWatch is the service in AWS that consolidates and compiles and offers insights across logs. And, you know, every Lambda function creates logs, creates start time and time, some context around it. And you can run analysis to say, cold started this many times. It was average running for this amount of time. It was throwing errors. It wasn't throwing errors. And you use that to isolate where does the work need to go.
Are you using CloudWatch for most of your reporting? Or are you integrated with someone external like Datadog or someone like that?
Yeah, we use Datadog primarily for insights and overall dashboards. But we tend to go with CloudWatch when we're like actively triaging something.
Yeah.
Because it's just so fast.
Yeah.
You know, we're already in there. We're looking at the logs. We can hop over to insights and run almost a SQL-like query to get logs with specific error messages or without specific error messages to point you to the answer really quick.
Yeah, the CloudWatch logs, I don't know what they call it, but it's like a SQL type interface. That's so cool.
It is. And I go long stints of time without using it. And every time I go back and use it, I'm mad at myself because I haven't been using it.
All right. What I was going to ask is, so when you deploy like these SAM functions, you use the AWS CLI, does it give you any kind of like site reliability dashboard? I mean, I guess we said it gives you the CloudWatch logs, but I know like for other services, so for example, like AWS Parallel Cluster, which is where you can build high performance compute clusters on AWS, they actually give you like this really nice interface where it integrates CloudWatch and metrics and auto scaling. And I don't know what all, but it puts it all in like a nice Grafana dashboard for you. So like when you deploy the service, because it's a service that is deployed of many other services, then you just get the pre-configured dashboard that is sort of your one-stop shop for all of those, which is, I've really been liking that lately. And I'm kind of just sort of going all in on projects that already have that built out for me so that I don't have to build them out. And then also my clients really like that because I'm like, look at this nice dashboard that you have now, and that's great.
I really like the questions that you ask, Julian, because they bring out some interesting things as it relates to serverless, because the serverless stuff, it doesn't have, you traditionally don't monitor the same things that you would monitor with a Kubernetes cluster or pack of EC2 instances. I know that's not the right word, but escape me for a second. You have to monitor totally different sets of data. Datadog does, yes, provide dashboards kind of out of the box for serverless monitoring, but I want to talk about what is different with that. Now, since it is all stateless, it's not like we can go in and check the status of a server for X, Y, or Z. When something goes wrong, the developers have to take that into consideration at development time, where they push things off to a dead letter queue. Essentially, that's the stateless version of an error queue, where something goes wrong that I didn't expect. I'm going to pop it over to a queue in SQS marked as a dead letter queue. I'm going to report on when things go in there. So I can monitor and see, based on how granular I get with these queues, where are there problems that I don't expect. So it's for the SRE kind of view of a serverless environment, it's different. It's how fast are your Lambda functions running? Are your state machines running and erroring out? Are they, what's the average execution time? What queues have items in them? What's the average duration of items that are in your queues, if you're using them as like a buffer for high load or burst? Very different. We're not monitoring memory utilization and CPU, because that's been abstracted away from the developers. So just kind of a whole different approach to SRE in general.
That is very interesting. It's going to take me a bit to wrap my head around, especially when you said you don't need to know about memory or CPU. That just kind of blew my brain a little bit. I don't know how I feel about that. That is very interesting to know that it's a whole different world. Because I've been thinking about going a little bit more like microservices, serverless for an application that I'm building. But then I'm like, oh, it looks so complicated and there's so many things that I have to keep track of. And I could just have one thing. Like one, and it's not very shiny, but it's one thing that I have to keep track of. So this is good to know. I'm glad that we've moved on to the me and my problems segment of the show.
An interesting thing about getting started with serverless is the curve, the learning curve is different. You can get started. You can deploy probably that one thing that you want in serverless AWS in like 10 minutes. And it would be up in the cloud. It would automatically scale. It would be resilient and it would just work. But you start throwing in complex workflows and effectively managing state and going through like choreography routines and whatnot. That's hard. It's very hard to pick up and learn. So, you know, if you look at the learning curve visually, you know, it starts like this and then it goes like that as you get into more complex scenarios. Eventually it clicks and you start understanding, oh, okay, this is how you track something that's lost or whatever. You know, it goes back up to a normal to a standard curve. But it's quick, slow, and then, you know, average for the learning curve.
Are there any kinds of problems you think are particularly well suited to having a serverless architecture?
When I started about 3 years ago, I was asking myself the same question. And, you know, I would pick and choose things that made sense to me and try to think of it conversely let me stop that, but I've kind of grown. I'm not going to answer your question.
That's not what we do.
Booyah!
I've come of the opinion now where I can't really think of any workloads that aren't good, that you can't solve with serverless. One exception. I have one exception and I will share that with you. I went down a route for virus scanning files. So the big file management service in AWS is called S3. And one of the things that we offer in our application is everything that gets uploaded into S3 is going to be virus scanned. You know, we will take that on. We'll take on the burden of making sure that we're offering it to you. It is not a virus. Sounds like a nice thing for any company to do.
Seems reasonable.
And we started off, right? We started off as a serverless solution with that. It was slow. It would take, on a good run, a small file. Let's say I uploaded a text file that had my name in it. It would take 29 seconds to virus scan that one file because that Lambda function, because it is stateless, has to go in, has to start. It downloads all of the virus definitions. It runs the scan and then it does the follow-on thing. It goes and reports out what's going on. So about 30 seconds for a small, tiny file. And you know, that grows linearly as the size of the files get bigger. So what we ended up doing after time, we're like, this is ridiculous. This takes way too long, is we ended up just spinning up an EC2 instance with some small Linux container that's always on. It always has the virus definitions preloaded and it can get still triggered when an object goes into S3. And the difference was incredible. The first time we got it working, there were three of us on the phone call at the time. We all said, oh, wait, it says it's clean. Did it run? How did that get tagged? So we tried it again and it immediately said clean. So we thought maybe the virus scanning process is just being skipped and it's just going on to the final state. But we eventually uploaded like a 10 gig video file or something and it took 3 seconds. So we were like, oh, it is actually doing something. It is just that fast running it in EC2 versus serverless. So that is definitely the one use case that I have that is better suited for that. You know, that kind of segues into, yes, there are other things. Like if you do heavy object analytics, like a video conversion or things like that, or virus scanning, it's probably better suited using a EC2 instance. But for things that require data transformation or data transportation, serverless, absolutely.
What's the current maximum runtime of a Lambda function? Because it used to be 15 minutes. Is that still the case?
I believe it is.
Okay.
Believe it is. I'm also of the opinion that if you have a Lambda function that's even close to that, you're doing it wrong. There's probably another way that you can approach that problem than using a Lambda function, be it breaking it up into X number of pieces and have them orchestrated using another AWS service called Step Functions. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that's something that would be better suited in EC2, because having a 15-minute execution of a Lambda function is expensive.
Yeah, long-running ETL jobs on big data sets is where I encountered that.
Yeah, that would do it.
Does that mean that doing things like streaming video should not, or audio should not be done through Lambda functions, or does it require a different kind of approach?
Streaming is an interesting concept there, because with AWS, you can actually proxy that straight out of the S3 object. You don't even have to use Lambda functions.
But suppose you want to do some sort of transform or something, or you want to, yeah, I don't know what, you're doing a transform, or you're mixing two audio channels, or I don't know what you're doing. But
no machine learning.
Something that's more
like
than just streaming. Not just
I'm with you.
Dumb streaming, but actually processing a stream.
Yeah, that's, there are ways. If you're adamant on using Lambda functions, which I'm not going to say it's, you should always try, no matter what. You know, you don't fit a square peg in a round hole if it's really not. I always say serverless first. Try it. If it's really not the best fit, don't use it. But for things like that, you know, you can stream out of S3, process a little bit, put it back, process a little bit, but you're probably better suited using something that's up that has a state that you can load that object into. It's probably an EC2 instance or something there. Anytime you're dealing with giant files, it's really not suited for Lambda function.
What do y'all have, like a ops, IT, or DevOps team? And if so, how do they integrate with a serverless world?
We do. And you can see my hesitation.
I was waiting for the but.
It's not because I don't want to share. I don't really know, because the way that we've ended up running the dev teams so far in this journey is, for lack of a better word, it's siloed. The engineers that are on my team, they do all of it. They do SRE, they do infrastructure, they do the code, the triage issues, that it's all contained. These full stack engineers can do all of it. Spreads the whole gamut.
I got you. Responsibility. I got you. So those teams exist, but you don't have any interaction with them.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah. Typically when we have problems with anything networking, because we don't deal with networking in serverless, it's all handled by the cloud vendor. But if there's a random use case where we have to, we talk with those guys because they know what they're doing.
Right on. Cool.
I won't deal with networking either. Just not doing
it. That's good. And my focus, I have a software engineering degree from the University of Texas at Dallas with a focus in networking. And I made the wrong call on that one.
Wait, so there's more to networking than sudo IP tables off?
Nope, that's it.
Okay. All right, cool. I was worried about my certification for a minute.
Even when I worked in IT, I wouldn't deal with networking. I'd get one of the other. I would do like the coding stuff, and I would make them do the networking stuff. It's like, come on, let's trade here.
I used to love networking. That was one of my early loves with IT, back when it was coax cables. Now that networking means defining VPCs or whatever, I'm lost, and I just throw it away. Like, yeah, whatever. Go give me a working system, and I'll be happy. I don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah, it's a quick way to establish yourself as the smartest person in a room. You can start confidently talking about networking.
For hiring new developers, what does your documentation look like? Do you have any type of like big diagrams that show the high level Lambda functions or something like that?
Yeah, yes. We have infrastructure and architecture diagrams, both, that we share with new people and people that aren't even on the team that are interested in what we're doing. There are a lot of tools out there, CLI-based tools, that can take these infrastructure as code files and generate infrastructure diagrams from them, just using like Draw.io, which are super, super useful for getting a picture of what's getting deployed in the cloud. You know, but we also provide architecture diagrams, which offer a little bit higher level abstraction of here's how the data flows through the system. Not necessarily the resources that are being used, but this is how the data gets transformed and saved and sent over to, you know, this consumer. We found that results in the quickest turnaround for getting a developer up to speed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, programmers know how to code. So, you know, it's not necessarily looking at the code that's going to get them up to speed on the domain knowledge and how it's working. It's looking at these diagrams that tell them what it's doing and where its piece of the puzzle is.
Yeah, for sure.
I just want to say I took a quick look at your blog, and my favorite article is the distributed computing explained simply with Duck, just because of the Duck. I thought that was fun.
Thank you. I'm actually super, I'm really proud of that one. I thought that was a good way to describe it. I was actually driving in the car. I was going, you know, everywhere in Texas, it takes a long time to drive just because Texas is so big. And I was on like a 2-hour car ride, and I was thinking about a conversation that I had earlier that week about distributed computing, because I was trying to explain it to people and they just weren't getting it. I was explaining, here's this limitation of what's going on, and that's just kind of the way that it is given how we built the system. And it just wasn't clicking. And so I was in the car and I was thinking, it's like, okay, how can I explain this in a way that everybody gets it? So came up with that duck analogy, which worked, which, you know, people see that and they kind of get it, just high level what it is. If you imagine, it's just a circle of ducks at the park and you have bread. My disclaimer, I put this in the blog post, don't feed ducks bread. but you have a big loaf of bread. And you toss the bread in this circle of ducks. They'll obviously go for it. Most of the time, one duck will get it and eat it, and there's not a problem. But there will be other times where you throw a piece in it and two ducks grab it at the same time, and they both get a piece. And I relate that to distributed computing with queues, where you have a bunch of servers, ducks, they're looking at the same thing, right? So an object or something comes into a queue that's picked up by a distributed system, that's your bread, and two servers grab it at the same time, right? If one of the server was slightly faster, it would have been picked up once. But when you have two servers that pick up the same object in a queue at the same time, you're going to get duplicate processing of the same record, which is one of the big problems. One of the big problems of distributed computing. The other one is guaranteed, or just once delivery is what I just did, but guaranteed order is the other one, right? If I throw three pieces of bread into this ring of ducks at the same time, can't guarantee that third piece of bread is going to get eaten last and the first one's going to get eaten first, right? I'm going to have to take the ducks away until there's only one to guarantee that the bread that I throw is going to get eaten in the order that I throw it. Very interesting distributed computing.
And an excellent.
That's such a great analogy. Yeah, for real.
Thank you. That was a fun one for me to think about and then to ultimately write about and explain that to other people around the company.
I think that could be really fun, like PowerPoint presentation. Just wait until you get
quantum
too.
Physics involved there. And
what was that, Jonathan?
Just wait till you have quantum physics involved, and then first doesn't even mean anything except based on where you're actually positioned. I saw that duck eat the bread first, but Jillian says she saw the other duck eat the other bread first.
That's right.
It sounds completely esoteric, but the same sorts of concepts do start to apply to distributed computing when you consider clock sync isn't always perfect, right? That one view of first might be different than someone else's view of first, but that's taking the analogy far too far and getting off topic, so I'm going to shut up now.
Quantum computing is another one that I don't understand. I just look at it and I'm like, oh, I don't get this. I'm getting too old for this stuff.
Which one?
Quantum computing? Like, because, you know, now at least AWS has some articles about quantum computing out, and I just, like, I don't know, kind of get it.
We need an episode on quantum DevOps.
There we go. Let's get somebody from AWS here on the quantum computing.
I've always said to my brother growing up and said to my wife now, it's like, you know, I've always wondered, what is the tech that's going to stump me? Like, tech I grew up with stumped my parents. It's like, I'm in high tech all the time, every day. And, you know, I just have a hard time thinking that there's going to be something that comes out where I just can't wrap my mind around it. And quantum computing is a good example of, okay, yeah, there's that definitely going to be things that I do not get. Yes, so my kids are going to have to try to explain to me simply.
I'm already there with my kids explaining things to me. I was trying to figure out how to live stream like tutorial kind of stuff. So it's a lot of text on a screen, and I was trying to do it like through a browser, but then you get these weird artifacts. And then I installed this program that's like records it locally and then streams it to YouTube or Twitch or whatever. And I was extremely impressed with myself until I went and told my kids about it, and they were like, well, duh, you know, like that's what all the streamers use. So,
I think that's it, you know, because I feel like I'm getting pretty old now, but I still understand a lot of the tech that I get paid for. But like the entertainment level tech, it's just I avoid it because it's downright embarrassing to watch me, you know, like something similar to what you were describing, Jillian, you know, recording a video on my phone. If I do it in front of someone, they're like, what industry do you work in again? Are you sure you're technical? It's like, no, I promise I am. Stop making fun of me.
I'm told there's good money in some of the legacy positions because everybody else like retires or dies or goes off to like run a bar or something. So you know, so then there's only a few of us left, and then you can demand a high salary and good benefits and things. Every once in a while, I get contacted for like a pro job like that.
I think there's actually like a legit shortage of COBOL developers right now.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, website in the U.S. that it kept going down, and they were trying to find developers to work on it, and they couldn't find anybody. That was an interesting story.
Yeah,
I think that applies to airlines too. I know a few guys who work for a large airline, and like the core of the reservation system still runs in COBOL on the mainframe because of the level of effort that it takes to port that over. They're just like, nah, we'll pay anyone any amount of money to avoid that problem.
There's nothing wrong with that being future us problem.
Right? Future Will's going to be pissed, but that's his problem, not mine. Cool. Well, is there anything else we should talk about on this subject?
I think we have done a very exhaustive job here.
It was entertaining. I enjoyed it.
Hi, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs, and lately I've been coaching some people on starting some podcasts and in some cases just taking their career to the next level. You know, whether you're beginner going to intermediate, intermediate going to advanced, whether you're trying to get noticed in the community or go freelance, I've been helping these folks figure out how to get in front of people, how to build relationships, and how to build their careers and max out and just go to the next level. So if you're interested in talking to me and having me help you go to the next level, go to topendevs.com/coaching. I will give you a 1-hour free session where we can figure out what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go, and figure out what the next steps are. And then from there, we can figure out how to get you to the place you want to go. So once again, that's topendevs.com/coaching.
Let's move on to picks. Jonathan, have you got picks for us this week?
I don't.
All right, Jillian.
I don't have anything ready. Oh, I do. I do have something ready. I do have a pick. I bought some new Bluetooth headphones or earbuds that I like. They're the Jabra 75T. I had the 65T for a couple of years. They broke, so I just switched to the 75T. They also have the 85T, but that was a little outside my price range. Anyway, I like them. They're comfortable. They fit in my ears well. They work for my audiobooks. I'm not really an audiophile. I don't listen to music that much. So if you're an audiophile, I can't tell you whether they're good or bad. But they work great for not falling out of my ears when I'm going on a walk or whatever. I'm listening to my audiobooks and podcasts. So if you're not listening to Adventures in DevOps on a Jabra 75T, you should be.
Use discount code. Just kidding.
My Amazon affiliate link.
Right. All right, Jillian, what do you got?
So I'm going to go with the shameless self-promotion this week. I finally got... Nice. I finally got a product I've been working on mostly through the AWS Marketplace approval process. So first of all, I'm feeling extremely impressed with myself for the level of effort that took, because it was a lot, you guys. It's not serverless, but it's still cool. It is doing single cell analysis, which is a type of bioinformatics analysis on AWS, and people can go into the marketplace when it's like fully approved. Now it's a bit odd. Like AWS approves it first as sort of like a concept, I guess, and then you actually have to go into the marketplace and fill out all the technical details and things. But at some point, scientists will be able to go into the marketplace and click a button and get a very nice visualization platform for doing single cell analysis that's all built off of open source software. So the AWS marketplace product that is paid, because if I'm going to go through that, somebody is paying me. But there is also version. There's nothing like, you know, behind the paywall. It's all there. So yeah, so if you happen to be in the bioinformatics space, you know, you can go to the AWS marketplace and look for bioanalyze cell by gene gateway, and it'll pop right up. That's that. That's my whole pick.
Right on.
Awesome.
Alan, have you got a pick for us?
Yeah, you know what? I'm actually going to piggyback off of Jonathan and try to one-up him. Good try. I actually really, really like the Bluetooth headphones that I use. They're from Wyze. I don't know if you guys know Wyze, but you know, they started off selling really inexpensive webcams, like $20 webcams, like 1080p, two-way voice and all that. But they've branched out. They got some VC funding and started creating a bunch of other products in a bunch of different spaces. And they have these over-the-ear headphones that are super cheap for what they are. They're like $80. And they offer noise canceling. They're like incredible bass, Bluetooth that hooks up to two different Bluetooth devices.
Oh, nice.
At the same time, they can toggle back and forth. Had one other thing that was cool about them. Oh, it has Alexa built in, which is neat. So you can just talk to that. And then it also has like a one-touch auto-off white noise. So it has noise canceling. I can just, I have two small kids and I work from home. And they're always screaming. So put the headphones on with the white noise. Don't even necessarily have music playing. But if my wife walks into the room, I can just put my hands over the right earmuff and it turns off the music. It turns off the white noise and I can hear just transparent. Super cool.
Oh, wow.
And cheap, $80. And it's like, well, that's a no-brainer for me.
Right on. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So those are over-the-ear ones, you said, right?
Yeah.
Cool. So that's nice. Cool.
All right. So I've got three picks this week. The first one, I guess, was like fate combined with destiny because I'm wearing my Austin, Texas DevOps Days t-shirt. Alan's from Texas. And I just got the email day before yesterday. Austin is doing their 10th anniversary of DevOps Days. And so they're inviting past speakers to come back and talk, which I spoke there in 20, I think it's either 2016 or 2017. So if you're going to be in Texas around Austin, May 4th and 5th, give a, you know, check out the DevOps Days. They do a great, great event. My second pick is actually one of Jonathan's podcasts from Tiny DevOps that came out this week. Do investors really care about DevOps? Where he sat down with Rob Walling and had that chat. And that was actually a really, really cool chat because you read the title and you're like, ah, this is clickbait. But then I listened to it anyway and it was great. I mean, it was a really cool conversation you had with Rob and very insightful. And then my last pick, I downloaded this app on my phone called Forest App. It's a Pomodoro timer, you know, so you work for 25 minutes and take a 5-minute break, but it's kind of got like this old school SimCity screen in it. And so for every Pomodoro you do, it grows a tree on the landscape. And it's actually kind of addicting to just fill up the little land with different trees. And when you fill that up, you know, it adds another plot of land to it, just like SimCity 2000 did. So those are my three picks.
And if you turn it off, it will kill your tree. Like if you interrupt your Pomodoro in the middle to be like, no, I need my phone. It will be like, I'm going to kill your tree. Are you sure?
It does. And it leaves like this little brown stubby branch where the tree would have been.
Wow.
I like that one too.
Cool. All right. I guess we're done.
That's it.
Thanks, everybody.
Moving on.
It was fun.
Tune in next time when we're completely serious with no jokes at all.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.